So I actually remember what episode we're recording today. This is, I think, episode number 042.
I think it's 43.
Oh, man. Welcome to the Inform Podcast. This is episode number 043. I thought it was 42, but Jared, the cat's meow of the podcasting world, corrected me, along with performing that public service for our listeners. Jared, would you like to say hello or meow or anything to get us started today?
I'll say hello and meow. I'll say both.
Oh, wow. What a treat for me and for the listeners. All right, so
that's what I do.
That's what you do, man. That's what you do. So what's going on, Jared? You got any announcements that you want to get into before we launch into our first segment, the psychoanalysis of everyday life?
I don't know if I'm important enough to have announcements. So I guess that's my way of saying no, I don't have any announcements. Have you got in the way of announcements?
Just one announcement that I wanted to kind of toss out here. So this morning, one of the listeners of this podcast sent me an email, and then I responded, and I think I CC'd you on the response. Mm-hmm. And they were asking about a reference that we had tossed out in episode, I think it was number 30, about the waiting room and psychoanalysis and stuff. Anyway, through that email exchange, one of the things that came up is that there's a couple of really great resources that people who listen to this podcast might want to check out. And those resources are the Lacanian Review, which is a periodical that gets published. I think it's twice a year. And the other one was Lacanian Inc., also published twice a year. And then there was the Lacanian Works Exchange, which is this really wonderful website where people can go and they can find lots and lots and lots of very useful, very interesting PDFs that relate to a lot of the stuff that we talk about on this podcast. And so I just kind of wanted to, I figured if this one listener, you know, was asking us about that, perhaps other people also wanted to know about these things. And so rather than just sending out like one email reply, which I did, I thought, you know, might as well do it at the top of the podcast just so that people learn about these cool resources that are out there if they're, you know, really interested in digging into Lacanian thought and understanding it more than they do now. These are all resources that I use regularly, and I'm really glad that they exist.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good idea. I'm glad you brought that up. It hadn't crossed my mind. I'll add one more thing. So the Lacanian Review also publishes what they call the Lacanian Review Online, which is some really short pieces that are always really, really interesting. I don't even know how to describe them because they'll talk about anything. They're essays from different people from different points in time. Sometimes it's from old essays that they wrote a long time ago. Sometimes it's stuff they're writing specifically for the Lacanian Review Online. Like there's so much. There's hundreds of entries. It's fun.
Yeah.
And you can get them sent straight to your email. Forgot about that.
Yeah, you can do that. You can subscribe to an RSS feed if that's your thing. Mm-hmm. And everything that's up there at the Lacanian Review Online is 100% totally free.
Yes.
You know, obviously the Lacanian Inc. and the Lacanian Review are periodicals that you'd need to subscribe to and pay for. Lacanian Works Exchange is a free resource, and the Lacanian Review Online is also a free resource. So that's cool. Those are some good announcements. I'm glad that we did that. Hmm. But what we'll do now is transition into our next segment, which is the psychoanalysis of everyday life. All right. So, Jared, I think that you are up this week. What is going on in your normal everyday life that, I don't know, is psychoanalytic in some way?
So this is really fresh. This is something that that came up yesterday. So in a session that I had somewhat recently, we were talking about signifier and sign. That's something we were talking about. And that had just sort of been like eating away at my brain throughout the rest of the day and throughout the evening. And it occurred to me that if you take the I-F-I-E-R off the end of signifier, you get the word sign. right? So the word sign is built into the word signifier, obviously. This is nothing that's groundbreaking yet. Then I thought of a different word that has that same I-F-I-E-R on the end of it, the word pacifier. I have a 2-year-old daughter. We decided to use one with her when she was quite young. She doesn't use it quite so much now, but whatever, it crossed my mind. And what crossed my mind about it is that I already said you can slash it in half and it turns into the same thing. You can take off the F-I-E-R and you're left with just this little word, passy. And that's what I called it for my daughter for a very, very long time while she was using it regularly. And it's weird how it aligns with the word sign. I think that I haven't talked this over, so I'm spitballing right now. But I think that the word passy and the function of the sign are very closely aligned for me. I think that when she was using it all the time, the passy functioned as a response to a sign, and the sign was something obvious. Like I knew what she needed in that moment. I knew what I could do to make it better for her in some other way. But, and this is a greater part of my own analysis, so I'm going to be a little bit vague. But when it comes to signifiers, when it comes to pacifiers, I struggle more. Hmm. And so it's a weird thing. It's a, you know, you read quite a bit about how these tiny little sound, these phonemes can get used in an analysis. And, you know, it's come up a little bit here and there for me before, but this time, as I was thinking this over last night, was probably the most obvious it had been, the most like powerful that it had been for me. I don't know exactly how to describe why it was so powerful. I just know that these two little pieces of a word, this passy and this fire, were just like indispensable in that moment. And I'm blown away by how that worked for me. So I don't know, maybe that's a little, what's the word I'm looking for? Maybe I've let you inside my own psyche a little bit here, but I thought it was worthwhile because, you know, it's easy to read about that type of stuff and it's a little bit harder to experience it. You can't really look for it, you know? It's something that I don't think you can just sort of puzzle over and finally think, oh, here, I've found a really well-operating signifier or a sign in my life. I don't know. I thought it was fascinating for me.
That is interesting. So to try to kind of, what I want to do here is say a little bit more about the terms signifier and sign, or maybe ask you to say a little bit more about them, because I find that very often people, when they hear those words, they start to kind of like go like, oh, they're doing the Lacanian jargon thing, time to tune out, you know, and go do something else for a little bit. What's the difference for you? I mean, when you think there's a sign, what's a sign and how is it different from a signifier? And with that in mind, it might, I think, also help sort of, you know, whoever's listening to this right now, understand the significance of what it is that you just described.
Sure. So in the way that I think about it, a sign has a sort of a fixed meaning to it. It's like tied down. There's nothing ambiguous about it. There's a there's a clarity to it that makes it really easy to understand what it is that's being asked. You've given this example on this show before of somebody asking, I think we were talking about subject of the statement and subject of the enunciation, but I think it's an example that works here. Somebody walks up to you and says, do you have the time? Like, do you know what time it is? Or something like that. I think that's one example maybe of a sign. They're asking you, like, I don't know what time it is, but I need to know what time it is. Could you please tell me what time it is? There's very little ambiguity in that, I think. I mean, maybe you could take it a different direction if you wanted, but I think it functions well as an example. It's a very clear, like, piece of information almost. Like, it's tied specifically to a thing, kind of. A signifier, on the other hand, is a lot more free-floating. It operates in a more, I don't know, directionless kind of is a word that comes to mind, but I don't think it's quite the right one. It's more free floating. You can say, what time is it? And that's sort of a sign. Or you can say, do you have the time? I slipped a minute ago and said that when I meant to say, what time is it? But do you have the time could offer as a signifier, or could function as a signifier rather than a sign. It's got a polyvalence to it. It could mean, look at your watch and tell me it's, you know, whatever, it's 12 o'clock. Or it could mean like, do you have the time to help me out? Do you have the time to listen to my pitch? Do you have the time to hear about the word of God? And so on and so forth. Like, it's got all these different things going on with it.
Yeah. So, I mean, tell me if you think this kind of gets at what you're getting at here. If someone, imagine this type of a scenario, like you're in a classroom and the clock is clearly broken. You know, it's like, you know, it's sometime around 3 p.m. and the clock says like 11 a.m. or something like that. So you look at it and you know, okay, that's wrong. If you turn to somebody and you say, hey, what time is it? That's a pretty clear question. It's a query for some specific information, right? And so you're probably going to get a pretty expected response from that. Like the message that you send, the message that's received will be as close to the same as they can be. And the person will probably, if they have a watch or a phone or something like that, just look at it and tell you what time it is. Now, if somebody were to look at you in the same class, right? Like the class is going on or whatever, and they look over at you and they go, so they say something like, so, are you having a good time? That's more of a signifier, right? There's a lot of ways that could go. There's many different directions that the person might answer in. It would depend on so many things, their relationship with you, if they are having a good time or not, if they like the class, the content, the professor, who knows, all that sort of stuff. Is that kind of what you're getting at, or am I missing it?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm getting at. Yeah.
So this is interesting. So what I think you're getting at here in this is that a lot of times in everyday life, right, people who you communicate with will, without realizing it, believe that they and you are communicating at the level of the sign. They will think that's what's happening. You know, I said something and what I meant when I said it was totally understood by both me, the speaker, and you, the listener. And so there won't be any errors or anything in the communication. I'll say something, you'll understand it, and then you'll respond because in the right way because you understood it. That's the fantasy of the sign, maybe. When in reality, what happens more often than not is that we're communicating at the level of the signifier, where there's all sorts of different ambiguities in play. And that means that, one, when I say something to you, there's the subject of the statement, what I'm saying, there's the subject of the enunciation, there's things kind of operant in my own speech that I'm kind of unaware of. So I don't understand myself all the time, one. And two, when you hear me speak, you're processing what you hear, you know, defining the words in your own kind of way and making your own associations, blah, blah, blah. And you're constructing your own meaning of what it is that I'm telling you, and what you construct versus what, you know, I'm constructing, there's probably going to be differences in these two things. And so we miscommunicate like all the time. Human communication is just miscommunication, especially if we're talking about anything that is substantive, anything that is significant. I know that this is sort of like your segment, but can I tell a silly story real quick?
Of course.
All right, cool. I didn't want to like steal your thunder or anything like that. So when I was in undergrad, I was getting my undergrad, and I met a girl in a class. It was a film class, and we hit it off and we started dating. And it was like, this was my serious college relationship. This is a relationship that lasted for quite a few years. And this girl, she was a smoker. She smoked. I did not. I've never been a smoker. And her parents, she lived with her parents at the time. And she thought that her parents didn't know that she smoked. And her parents totally knew that she smoked. I know this because her dad told me one day, he's like, they're Polish. And so I'm going to do a bad Polish accent here. He's like, she thinks that we do not know that she smokes. It's obvious. Right. And I'm like, yeah, I know. He's like, I'm not asking you to confirm this. You know, it's don't put you in this position. You're her boyfriend. It's not necessary. But he's telling me, like, I know that my daughter smokes. She tries to hide it. It's ridiculous, right? That was the situation that I was in. Her mom, not so much. I think her mom also knew that she smoked, but was perhaps less willing to admit that this was going on. Hmm. So anyways, one day, I remember I had a class, and then my plan that day after my class got out was to drive over to her parents' house where she was, and we were going to, do something that day. We didn't have any specific plans. It was just we were going to hang out. So class wraps up. I drive over to her house, and I get there, and I'm hungry, right, at the time. And so she says, what do you want to do? I'm like, I think we should go get something to eat. Is that all right with you? And she's like, yeah, I'd like to get something to eat. And I'm like, cool. I messed up the story. She had already eaten, but she's like, but I'll go with you. That's what she said. So I'm thinking to myself at this moment, okay, she's already eaten. I haven't eaten. We should do something that's like really quick, super easy. And so I said, well, what do you want to go pick up some Burger King? And she looked at me and she goes, fine. And she said it like that. Fine. So I knew I was in trouble, right? And I'm like, I'm like, dude, we don't have to go to Burger King. If you don't want Burger King, let's go to a different place. Anywhere, really. I just said it because I thought it was easy. She goes, no, if you want Burger King, let's go to Burger King. And so I'm like, oh no, this isn't going to be good. So we get in the car and we're driving to the Burger King, and she's looking out the passenger window away from me as we're doing this. And I'm like, oh man, she's really mad. I don't know why she's really mad. And so I ask her, I'm like, I think that you might be mad at me, but I'm sorry, but I don't know why you're mad at me right now. I don't understand what has happened. And she doesn't say anything. She's just ignoring. She's being quiet at me. And I'm like, oh man, this is getting worse. I should just not talk. So I don't talk. And then, I go through the drive-thru at Burger King. I order food. We're driving back to her house. And she turns and she looks at me and she says, do you really not know why I'm angry at you? And I said, I really don't know why you're angry at me. I have no idea. And she goes, I wanted to smoke. And you should have said that we were going to go to Baker Square. Because if you would have said that, then we could have gone to Baker Square and I could have smoked. And when I got home, if I smelled like smoke, I could say it was because I was at Baker Square. And we were near the smoking section, and that's why I smell like smoke. So, because my parents don't know what I smoke. And I was like, that's ridiculous. But it was one of those things where I was like, I'm sorry. Do you want to just like change plans? I don't think that your parents are going to care if we don't come back to their house right now. And she's like, no, it's fine. It's fine. And so there was clearly something weird going on here. We got back there and she looked at me. She's like, maybe you should just go. Actually, and I was like, maybe I should. So I ended up not hanging out with my girlfriend that day because we were communicating at the level of the signifier. And it's a silly story, and I just felt like it was kind of funny to tell it. So there you go.
It's a good story. It demonstrates exactly what we're talking about, right? Like, I think people, you already said this, but I'm going to reiterate it, that people generally would really prefer, in a certain way, to be communicating at the level of the sign instead of at the level of the signifier. Like, they'd rather things were clear. I know what's expected of me. I know when I've done it correctly or incorrectly. I know these things, but that's not what happens most of the time. Probably, I think we're communicating at the level of the signifier.
Yeah,
and it's much harder. It's much harder to navigate when you're communicating at that level.
What's so funny about this is like the assumption there is so ridiculous that when she said, I'm like, have you eaten? I'd like to get food. And she's like, yeah, I've already eaten. That I was supposed to from that intuit that she wanted to go to Baker Square where she could smoke so she could continue to believe that her lie that she was telling her parents was working. I mean, it's nuts. But this is the kind of thing that actually people do all the time. That's the thing. This is not, I mean, the situation is rather silly and perhaps a little bit weird, but what's happening in the situation actually happens, I think, a lot more than most people tend to realize.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is the last thing that I think I'll note, that the signifier, when we're speaking on that level, it just keeps things open in a way that makes human existence, I think, part of what it is. Like, I think if we were communicating mostly in signs, that's something that, you know, a a deer communicates in signs, right? I don't think that deers are speaking on the level of the signifier. I don't think that like raccoons are speaking. I live in the woods, clearly, because I'm referencing all these woodland animals. But whatever, humans speak on the level of the signifier in a way that I think is pretty unique to humans. Maybe I don't know enough about, you know, other animals, but I think that humans do it the most. If there are other animals that do it, humans do it the most often, the most, I don't know. Just the most, there's more complexity in the way that humans do it if there are other animals that communicate with signifiers than signs.
And this is the thing that's kind of interesting, though, I find, right? Like in psychoanalytic work and just in everyday conversations, they're interesting insofar as there is miscommunication. Communication mm-hmm. where it is that kind of at the level of the sign, what time is it? Can you pass me the salt? There's not a lot of interesting stuff occurring in those sorts of things. But when people are saying something and they're being not completely understood, right, that miscommunication is actually really interesting. And I mean, the best example I think of that is flirtation. When people are flirting, what they're doing is they're almost like deliberately trying to operate at the level of the signifier. It's like, what does that mean exactly? That somebody said that, or that they said that way, you know, and people enjoy that. I mean, flirting is an enjoyable activity, and part of the reason it's enjoyable is that it's mysterious and you don't know exactly what's happening. A lot of times people see this as a source of frustration, but I think that one of the many insights of psychoanalysis is that miscommunication is fun. It's interesting. It's cool. You just kind of have to be willing to accept that it is more likely, you know, the case in most of the communication that you're having.
Yeah. You know, I lied a second ago. I'll say one more thing that you just made me think of, that, you know, even when we think that we're operating on the level of the sign, I would venture to guess that a lot of times we're actually not. The example I'm thinking of is Freud's writings. Like, I'm pretty sure that he thought he was being very, very clear in his writings, and yet there's still a lot of misunderstanding. And that's part of it, right? He wasn't communicating it with signs. He was communicating with signifiers. There was still a level of ambiguity that could be taken and run with.
I think that's a good ending point with that. Let's end with Freud and Freud communicating at the level of the signifier, because that's groovy. Right, so now we're going to get into the main thing that we're expecting to talk about today, which is a continuation of our conversation from the previous episode about psychoanalysis and the question of whether or not psychoanalysis actually needs to be something which is marginal. So I thought when we were talking about this, getting ready to do this episode, Jared and I were talking, and we thought it would be a good idea to do a quick recap of where our own thinking is today. You know, we recorded the last episode, we recorded however many days back, and, you know, we landed somewhere, and we've been thinking about that. I think each of us have been thinking about that ever since. So Jared, why don't you kick it off here? Where are you at today on the question of, does psychoanalysis need to be marginal?
I think that I have landed with my feet on opposite sides of a door here. I think where I landed at the end of our last episode, and where I've been since then, is that if psychoanalysis were to become the sort of dominant therapeutic paradigm, I guess, the way that it had been before, it would have to reinvent itself in some way. There would have to be some sort of change in the theory. We had talked about the Freud and the Oedipus complex and how that used to be something that caught his patients off guard. And then they came to him specifically saying, like, here are my Oedipal dreams, tell me about all of them. And so he reformulated the way that he saw his patients. And I think that we could take that and carry it over to psychoanalysis more generally, that if it were to become this hugely popular modality. Again, we would want to, it would have to undergo some sort of change to really become the subversive, the really surprising, the really real thing that it currently exists as. So that's where I landed. Where did you land at?
So I think I'm much more firmly, for now, in the camp that it does need to be marginal. I think it does need to be this way. And I'm thinking this for a couple of different reasons that I will attempt to make sense outside of my brain. So the first reason comes from the perspective, I think, of the analyst. And then the second will maybe be more from the perspective of the analysand. So from the perspective of the analyst, what comes to mind is there's a video, it's on YouTube. I'll try to find it again. I don't know if it's still up or not, because sometimes videos disappear from YouTube. But if it is there, I'll find it and I'll put it in our show notes. It's an interview with the psychoanalyst Adam Phillips at a conference that I think was called RSA. And when he was being interviewed, one of the things that I remember him saying that really stuck with me is that nowadays, you know, to get into a psychoanalytic training institute or to get into some, if you go to a Lacanian school instead of a more IPA style institute, either of those, right? There's just not a huge number of people who want to do that. There's a pretty small number of people who have the desire to seek out advanced psychoanalytic training and to go through a really kind of arduous process of learning about psychoanalysis by going through their own analysis, getting psychoanalytic supervision, probably doing lots of reading of things that you struggle to understand, so on and so forth. And when Phillips was talking about this, he was like, this is great. This is actually a really great thing, which I think threw the interviewer off because they weren't expecting that answer. And their kind of follow-up was like, why? Why is it good that not a lot of people go into training to do this thing that you seem to have to believe is really useful and helpful and good? And Phillip's answer was that the people who do decide to sign up for this, who go through the things you need to go through to become an analyst, they're people who really love psychoanalysis. They're not lukewarm about it. They're not trying it out, right? They're not like, maybe. They're like, no, this is the thing that I have found that for whatever reason, I buy this. I think this is the thing. I love this thing. And that means that the people who do this, right, they commit to it in the way that you do when you really love something. And this is a partisan point of view, and I understand that. I don't think that a lot of other psychotherapists have that same kind of love for whatever it is that they say they do. I know a lot of people who are psychotherapists, and many of them will be like, oh, I don't subscribe to any particular theory. You know, I'm kind of like eclectic, or I integrate from a bunch of different places. They'll say that, or they'll say like, I do whatever it is that they use the word client, you know, needs me to do, rather than saying like, this is my thing that I do. They're wishy-washy, right? They don't commit to anything. And again, partisan point of view, I believe that that has a negative impact on the treatment that they can provide to people, right? Because they're just trying to do stuff and hoping that it will make, I think, a client like them a lot of times, because that's what they love, is the client liking them as opposed to loving something else. But anyways, it looks like you wanted to say something here.
I just happened to be thinking about this yesterday. People use this phrase a lot. They say, a tool in your tool belt, right? They use that phrase a lot in the mental health world. And I don't think that you should close yourself off to all other, schools of thought. I think that's a bad idea. But I think that not having like a reference point to which all of those other things come back is just not good. The way that I was thinking about it yesterday is it's like having a bunch of drill bits, but not having a drill to put them in. Like, you've got all these drill bits, but what can you do with them? You don't have a drill for them to go into. So that's all I was going to say. I agree with you.
That's a really cool metaphor. I like that a lot.
I don't know where it came from, but I thought it was good too. Yeah. I, It's the tool belt metaphor. Just, it makes me want to pull my hair out where it came from.
Yeah. I don't know. This is one of the things that you brought up a really good point though, too. Right. Which is that, I mean, there's a lot of people who I come across who are very critical of psychoanalysis and they have their critique. And I actually enjoy talking to people who are critical of psychoanalysis, and I enjoy talking to people who aren't critical of psychoanalysis. Here's the thing. The people I know who are analysts, who've really committed to psychoanalysis, they're oftentimes extremely critical of it in some way. And what I mean by that is, so like, you know, you and I are very much, you know, kind of steeped in Lacan and Lacanian style of psychoanalysis, which means that I am pretty damn critical of ego psychology. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's people who are into ego psychology who are super critical of Lacanian theory. It's really interesting to have conversations with those folks, I find, because you're communicating with people who have an understanding of psychoanalysis, and you can have a really kind of cool disagreement if that understanding is there. Again,
and that's fine, right? That's fine.
Yeah, it's totally fine. I mean, I'm going to be partisan again here and say that I think that Lacanians generally have a better understanding of ego psychology than ego psychologists have of Lacanian theory, I would say that ego psychology is probably an easier thing to read and understand than Lacan, right? Who's really hard to read and understand. Mm-hmm. But you can have that thing. Anyways, this is a long tangent. What I was going to get at is, this is a point that Todd McGowan makes, I think, really frequently. If you're going to attack something, don't attack it from outside. Like, go into the thing and attack it sort of like internally. This is the Hegelian thing, right? It's using contradiction. It's finding the ways in which a system contradicts itself. And then that, if you can do that, which takes time, you have to invest the time into understanding the thing that you're, you know, engaging with and critiquing, then you can offer probably a pretty cool critique. But a lot of people aren't willing to do that with psychoanalysis because it's such a time consuming activity to get into mm-hmm. it and really understand it and whatnot. But I just think that the people who do the tool and the tool belt thing, they haven't done the work a lot of times to understand it. I just had a conversation with somebody about this very recently. I think it was like within the past couple of days where they're like, yeah, but psychoanalysis is this thing that, you know, is only for rich people. And I was like, it's interesting you'd say that. Like, what is your experience with psychoanalysis? And they were like, well, I don't, and they stammered because they didn't have any, right? You know, and I made them aware of like the ambulatorium and the CCPTs and the different thing in the way that many analysts now, like, you know, don't bill insurance, but they also don't charge people $1,000 an hour, mm-hmm. you know, for their services, so on and so forth. Anyways, yeah. So that was my first point, is that the people who go into psychoanalysis nowadays, they love it. They really, really dig it. They've committed to it. And that's a smaller number of people, which means that it's going to be a more marginal thing. And mm-hmm. like Adam Phillips, I see that as something which has, which can be viewed in a good way, right? It can also mm-hmm. be viewed in a bad way, but it can be viewed in a good way. So that was my first point. Second point, from the perspective of, I think, of the analysis, and this is the more complicated argument that I'm going to struggle to make sense outside of my brain. I think that, and I'm no exception to this, by the way, I'm totally implicated in what I'm about to say. When people come to a psychoanalysis and they start it out, you know, they think that they're open. They think, yeah, I want to do this. I want to get a good understanding of my own unconscious. I want that. But the reality is that you don't. Mm. You know, when people start an analysis, there's another desire, which is operant, which is a desire to not know things. This is why the things are repressed in the first place, is because of the desire to not know them. And knowing the things that come up in an analysis is, you know, you and I have talked about this, I think, many times. It isn't always a comfortable thing. It's a confrontation with a part of you that you wish kind of wasn't a part of you, but it is. And this is not an easy thing to endure, right? So I think it's probably not the kind of thing that you're going to be able to motivate like the masses to do, because it's like anything which is really, really hard. You're not going to get a lot of people to sign up for it. Right. maybe if it was more trendy, you would. I mean, I think yoga is something which is actually physically difficult, but a lot of people like it. You know, it's very trendy right now. Running is something which is very difficult, but there's a lot of people doing running. Those are all, like, I guess, both physical things too, having more to do with the imaginary body, but have something having to do with you, you know, you, who you are, and really kind of facing yourself in a way where you come to know all this stuff that is a part of you that you have hidden from yourself. Like, that is not an easy task. It's just really hard. And I think it's something that even the people who think they're in for it, they don't even know what they're signing up for.
Mm.
You know, and there's a lot of people, I believe, I don't know, have any sense of how many, but I think there's probably a lot of people who start like a psychoanalysis or a psychoanalytic psychotherapy, and like maybe about 3 months in, they give it up. You know, and they'll have different reasons for doing it. They'll say, oh, I can't make it worth my schedule. I don't have the money, whatever. And I think that that's just a lot of times more the desire to not know these things about themselves playing itself out by creating a defensible reason for terminating an analysis really early on. I don't know. Does this make any sense to you as I'm saying it? I have no idea if this makes sense outside my brain.
I think it does. I what it makes me think of all things is doing stand-up comedy. You were trying to use running and yoga as examples, but I think you're right that those being physical activities involving the body are somehow different. I'm not going to try to unpack that. I don't think I could. But I think stand-up comedy is something that is kind of similar. I did that for a couple of years when I was in college, and you have to stand up on a stage and sort of lay yourself bare in this kind of strange way. There's lots of people looking at you while you talk about sometimes intimate details about your life and making light of them at the same time. Like, it's a weird position to be in, and it's really hard. I mean, aside from having to be funny and write funny jokes, you also have to be okay with the fact that you're going to be just like sort of putting it all out there, intentionally or otherwise. You're going to be putting yourself onto a stage to be looked at and laughed at or booed. Or I've had stuff, somebody threw something at me once. I think they were just drunk, but yet, like, there's stuff going on, and you have to be ready to like accept that some of it's going to be good and a lot of it's going to be like really shitty, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes me think of something, strange association. So I know somebody who does stand-up comedy now, and he also does like improv stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's like on an improv team that does stuff. I was talking to him and I asked him, which one does he prefer? And he said, that's actually a really complicated question. And I'm like, what do you mean? It's not a complicated question. Do you like doing stand-up or do you like doing improv? Which one do you like more? He's like, no, they're really, really different things. And I was like, how are they so different? Right? Like, I don't get it. And he said, so here's the difference as I experience it. You know, when you do improv comedy, the audience is like totally on your side. They want you to succeed and they're willing to laugh usually very easily, even at things that aren't that funny, right? Like you're trying things out and you bomb and it doesn't work. And the fact that you tried it and it didn't work becomes funny. He's like, I get a lot of laughs, he said, when I do improv comedy. And he's like, and I don't think it's because I'm brilliant. I think it's just because I'm doing improv and it's a setting where people are like just willing to go like, oh, okay, sure, you know, and laugh with you. It's like doing stand-up comedy, you're in a room, it's dark, there's a lot of drunk people, and people can't see me doing this, so I'm going to describe what I'm doing. And he's like, they're just sitting there, and he crosses his arms and kind of squints his eyes. He's like, and the audience is just like, try to make me laugh. Try your best. What do you got? You think you're funny? I don't think you're funny. You're not funny. Get out of here. Right? He's like, that's the attitude that you get when you're doing stand-up. It's a totally different vibe, you know? And so I'm wondering about this, if like maybe psychotherapy is more like improv comedy and psychoanalysis is more like stand-up comedy is the thing.
That's funny.
You know, I don't know if there's anything there, but that's the association I had.
I think it's worthwhile to try to, maybe not right this minute, but to try to explore. I had never thought about that. That's a cool idea. But I think your friend is right. And to go a little bit further and to sort of connect it to Adam Phillips here, if you want to be good at comedy, you got to like really commit to it. Like it has to be, you have to be refining your jokes all the time. You have to be getting up on stage and doing it like night after night after night. If you want to be really good at it, it has to be something that you really genuinely buy into. And you probably have to be okay with the fact that you're not going to make very much money. And like all these things, it's really the people who become professional stand-up comedians are, they're very good at what they do and they really enjoy what they're doing, I think.
Oh, wow. That's interesting too, because as you're saying that, there's two thoughts that come to mind. One is that the comedian is somebody who has to have had a pretty traumatic, maybe, experience of castration.
I think so.
Because, I mean, that's what it is. I think that my friend who describes doing stand-up, I mean, you're not in power there, right? Like the audience has the power. You're the one who's being told, like, produce something, produce a joke, mm-hmm. make me laugh. And, you know, as you pointed out, right, it's hard. It's not like you can just decide to do that. Like, if I want to stand up right now, I can decide to stand up. It's really easy. Trying to make somebody laugh is a lot more difficult than that. Like, that's, so there's an experience of a demand, maybe, or a desire, I suppose, from the audience, a desire for humor, that you have to, you're not able to, you know what I mean? Like really do it. It makes me think that, you know, Freud talked about the impossible professions, you know, being politics, teaching and psychoanalysis. They were impossible because no matter how awesome you are at any of those things, you can always look at the things you're doing and probably say, I wish I was better or I could be better. Mm. And the people around you can probably say, I wish they were better. You know, your kid will say, I wish you were a better parent. And your students will say, I wish you were a better teacher. And your analysts will say, I wish you were a better analyst. And you'll say, yeah, me too. You know, so that's what makes them impossible. You never are like, yeah, I'm good at this. Maybe comedy, stand-up comedy is yet another impossible profession. I you know what I mean? And that's maybe what makes it interesting in a way, is that the impossibility of that position, you know?
And This is maybe a bit of a far-fetched connection here. So tell me if you think I'm wrong, but I think that to go back to marginality here, I think that the bigger a comedian gets, first of all, the less funny they are. I think in general, I think that a lot of times a comedian who becomes huge, their earlier work is better than their later work, but maybe I'm just a comedy hipster. I don't know. But I think there's something to that. And I think that there are a lot of really good comedians who stay marginal sort of on purpose. I've mentioned Maria Bamford a couple of different times on this show before. And she's someone who doesn't play like huge theaters. She's not bringing in you know, thousands of people into an auditorium. She's playing these smaller venues with, you know, maybe 150 people on them and so on. And she's excellent. Like her material is always got this, I don't know, this sort of rawness to it, this sort of like complete acceptance of her own castration that makes it just, it's fascinating to me to watch as someone who's interested in psychoanalysis and someone who did comedy for a little while. It's fascinating. So I think that there's a marginality to comedy as well. I don't know.
Yeah. Huh. That is interesting. There's probably so much more that we could say about this. I want to just kind of like take this and put it on the shelf for a possible future episode where we talk about.
Yeah, like, I think that's fair.
Psychoanalysis.
I think that's fair.
Comedy.
This really snuck up on us.
Yeah, it totally did. But I'm gonna be a jerk and do something here. There's another story I can remember. Where did I hear this? I have no idea. But it was, I guess Chris Rock was somewhere and another comedian showed up. I don't even know who the other comedian was. But as soon as Chris Rock saw him, he like went up to the guy and hugged him and went, "Oh, thank God, another comedian." I oftentimes think that's sort of the way that I feel about talking to other analysts in a way. And part of the reason for that is because psychoanalysts are such a marginalized, you know, small group of people, to be able to have another analytic type person you can talk to is fun. I mean, that's part of the reason I think that we both do this podcast, is that we enjoy having a conversation with another person who's really into this stuff. Ultimately. So that was my final thought on comedians, I guess. You wanted, but since I did that, I'm going to give you a chance. Anything else you want to say about comedians and psychoanalysis?
I don't have anything else to say about comedians and psychoanalysis for now. I think that's a fun discussion for another time. But what you just said reminded me of something, a book actually that both of us are reading right now, The Aims of Analysis,
yeah,
by Thomas Pholos.
Damn good book.
Yeah, it's excellent. If you're someone who's listening to this and you want to read it, I would so highly recommend it. It's so good. It's a lot about Lacan's later works. But so what you just said reminded me of was an anecdote in there, where he's talking, like, people are asking him questions after the seminar, and somebody gets onto the topic of you're a psychoanalyst in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places. What was it like trying to, you know, build up psychoanalysis in a place where you were the only one? And he said something like, I wasn't the only one. I wasn't alone. I had all these other analysts that are in other parts of the country, but, you know, they called me, they wrote me, we spoke, I went to their seminars, I attended their testimonies of the past, and like so on and so forth. And I think he was getting at something similar to what you're getting at right now, that, you know, it's marginal. There aren't a lot of psychoanalysts, but when you find them, it's like, I don't know. There's a camaraderie there. I think that's in part because of the marginal status that psychoanalysis has.
Yeah. I think there's definitely something to that. You know, as you say that, my thought is that, you know, trying to practice psychoanalysis in the modern day and age is actually really hard in certain ways, because there's not a lot of institutional support for it, right? Like, you're not going to find, you know, I guess like a hospital that's going to have a department of psychoanalysis or encourage people to find an analyst, I think, very often, right? They'll probably encourage people to do our partial hospitalization, an intense outpatient program, you know, which is going to be focused on something that's not psychoanalysis. There's a lot of that. I teach in a university, and, you know, even there, there's people who are like, you know, you need to maybe turn down the psychoanalysis a little bit, man. Like, I think you're doing a little bit too much psychoanalysis in what you're doing, because psychoanalysis, I mean, that's not really important for licensing. That's not really, you know, so I'll get those arguments on a fairly regular basis. It's hard. And even if, like, you know, you get your license to be a mental health professional and you join a group practice or you start your own practice, there's probably not going to be a line of people at your door saying, like, I'm here for psychoanalysis. There's going to be a lot of people who come in saying, like, hey, I have, you know, I have work-related stress. I makes me anxious. Or can you talk to my kid? My kid likes playing video games more than doing their homework. Can you make them care more about doing their homework? You're going to have a lot of that kind of stuff. This, like, fix me, cure me, make me behave differently things. And you're going to have a very small, if any, you know, number of people who show up saying, like, psychoanalysis, you do that? You know, that it's, you, so you're, this is the point that Jacqueline Miller makes, I think, a lot, is that to be an analyst, you have to be able to be alone, because the work is in a sense lonely work, right? You sit in a room, you have really interesting conversations, sometimes not, but a lot of times I'd say really interesting conversations, really particular conversations with people, and then that's it, right? Like, you tend not to talk about those a whole bunch outside of the room with other people because of the nature of what you're doing. And it's no matter what happens, it's kind of like just between you and this person, and you're alone when you're doing it, in a sense. It's hard. But you do, this is one of the reasons why it's so important, I think, to have things like the school, you know, in Lacanian psychoanalysis. The school, I think, is this, I guess, technology that different analysts can use. You can come together and you can talk, you know, with other people who understand something about something that's very important to you. But that, you know, it's, yeah, I don't know. And I imagine if that wasn't a marginal thing, I guess, is where I want to go with this. Imagine if it was like the same way. I mean, there's conferences that you can go to now that have lots and lots and lots of people coming to them. And that is a certain kind of experience. You're there. There's a lot of other people there. Maybe you know a few of them. There's a lot of them that you don't. If you go to psychoanalytic stuff, I find it's a rather different experience. They tend to be smaller kind of affairs. And the people who you talk to they're like in the same niche as you are, as opposed to talking to people who are maybe in kind of like adjacent niches, similar but also different. I know it's just such a different experience to do that. And it's, and I would agree with Tom Volos, who wrote The Aims of Analysis and also wrote 21st Century Psychoanalysis, which is another really great book. That's a point that he makes, and I think it's an important point about the marginality of psychoanalysis.
Yeah, I think there's something to it. I think there's, you're pushing me further to one side of the door. if I had feet on opposite sides of the door before, now I'm leaning more in the opposite direction towards a full on yes.
Why is that, do you think? I mean, like, what's happening that's making you, instead of being on the fence and thinking like, no, it doesn't need to be marginal, and now it sounds like you're coming more to the, it does need to be marginal side of the fence. Like, what do you think's causing that?
I think the question that I posed towards the beginning of this segment here, like, I guess it was less of a question and more of a hypothesis, that if psychoanalysis were to become a bigger thing, that it would have to shift its paradigm around a little bit. I don't know. I feel like a lot of the stuff that you've been saying so far gives me some evidence to the contrary. Like I think that part of the reason that Tom Svolos has been so influential, I guess, and so committed to this project. I mean, he's been doing it for decades at this point, is because there was nobody else like in his immediate area. He brought something there. And in this book, you'll find that he tried really, really hard to convince other, he's a psychiatrist by degree. Like, he's got, he went to medical school and blah, blah, blah. So he tried to, when supervising other psychiatrists, he tried to instill a certain love for psychoanalysis in them that just never took off. He says that not a single person was interested in it, at least not so interested in it that they were willing to start practicing in that way. And I don't know, it just seems like there's so much evidence saying that it probably does need to be marginal in that way.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
So here's another thought that I had. I didn't have this when we started the podcast, when we hit record and started recording today, but I've had it as we've been talking, and I don't remember when it came up. You were saying something like, ooh, I want to remember this. And I'm glad that I did here, because I'm really curious what you will think of this. So as we were talking about this and the, does psychoanalysis need to be marginal? One of the ways that we could think about this is to compare it to another like marginal kind of phenomenon. And the thing that comes to my mind right now is like the frontier, as which you'd see in like Westerns and things like that, right? Like if you watch those sorts of films. When you think about there was this time where there was like America that was this like established place, where there were cities and rules and people, roads and all that stuff, right? Which is nice. It's nice to have that stuff. I think I certainly enjoy having access to all those things. That was an America that was, not on the margin. It was in the center. It was the main thing. And then there was this frontier area. And when you crossed over into the frontier area, you crossed over into the margins of America. And in the margins, things operated differently than they did in like the regular part of the country. They didn't operate in the same way. One of the things that one of the ways I think I would describe the difference here is that in main America, non-marginal America, people did know what they were. There were rules and there were standards. There was a big O other that was very established. And kind of in a sense, you could say that people sort of like knew their place, and they largely followed the rules. They adhered to the standards. And once you crossed over into the frontier, into the margin, there was less of that. There was less rules. There was less standards. It was more, I mean, there were still some, but they were really different, right? I think that, the strength of the big other, once you crossed over into the frontier, diminished a lot. And that's that it was a, I wouldn't call it a lawless area, but I would call it a less lawful area, right?
Mm.
There were laws, there was customs in the frontier, but the enforcement mechanisms of those were nowhere near as robust as they were in non-marginalized America,
mm-hmm.
right? Am I making sense as I say this?
I think so. When you say it, I'm thinking of like, I don't know if this is a real thing, but they use it a lot in television and film about international waters.
Yeah, yeah. That I think that works just as well, right? It's a place where, I wish I could say this in a way that really sounded right to me. And I feel like I haven't found the right combination of notes here, but when you cross over into the margin, when you're in the frontier or the international waters or whatever, you're more free to try things out and see what happens. Because the big O other isn't as there, kind of making you feel like, oh, if I do this, I'll be in trouble. It's a place where you're not going to be in trouble, or if you are in trouble, it's not going to be big trouble. It's going to be little trouble. Maybe people will be irritated as opposed to you'll be brought up on charges. And I mean, it's also more dangerous there too, in certain ways. Like there, I think the point I'm trying to make here is that when you cross over from non-marginal to the marginal, there's this sort of like a major switch that occurs in regards to the way that the law functions. You know, in non-marginal areas, the law functions in a consistent-ish or more consistent way than it does when you cross over into the marginal areas. And you could see that as like crossing over into the marginal areas is taking a risk. You know, you're going into a place where the law doesn't have as much hold, as much purchase. That's dangerous. Yes, it is. But in addition to that, it's also kind of freeing. Like you can do more there as a result. I think if psychoanalysis were to cross over, you know, from this marginal kind of frontier area that it I think exists in today, and were to become non-marginal or to become mainstream, that what would happen is it would turn into this thing that had lots of rules, lots of standards. You know, okay, to be in now since a lot of people are into this, there's going to be an accreditation body and it's going to accredit, you know, places that train psychoanalysts, and there's going to be a license to become a psychoanalyst. And you, that means that there's going to be a thing that you need to do to keep your license, so on and so forth. This was the kind of stuff that in my mind, Lacan was just like saying no to. He said, no, no, no. That's what the IPA was doing at the time that he was kicked out of the IPA in 1963. They were, I think, taking psychoanalysis out of the margins and making it mainstream. And the effect of doing that was what I just described. They had these like very rigid things that people needed to adhere to and follow if, or they were not allowed to have an analytic experience as an analyst or an analysand. And what Lacan was saying is like, no, that's wrong. That's wrong, dudes. Like you're doing it wrong. It shouldn't be that way. And he tried to, I think, create a psychoanalysis, the Lacanian style of psychoanalysis, that didn't try to be mainstream, that operated in the margins. And I would also go on to argue, and this is something that I probably can't get too deeply into today because I haven't really prepared for it and it's a big thing. But, you know, as Lacan went from being somebody who was, you know, a psychoanalyst to being like Lacan, that was like a brand, you know, I think he struggled. I think that Lacan struggled as he became a more like mainstream figure in France. I think that had an effect on him and on the style of psychoanalysis that he was practicing. I think he wanted to be more marginal, and yet there was all these people and forces kind of like dragging him into the mainstream. But I think he wanted to stay in the margins because being in the margins just allows for certain things to happen that can't happen if you're in the mainstream. So anyways, there was a lot of stuff in that. I'll stop talking here and let you say whatever you want to say.
I think there's something there. I mean, I think of Lacan's latest seminars where he starts talking about like he really starts trying to like algebraize, I guess, his theories, and he starts getting really into knot theory in the, you know, in the really late seminars. He starts talking about like the Santome, the Borromean knot, the Borromean clinic. Like, you can see his ideas. He's trying to go further and further and further. And I hadn't thought about it until you just said it right now, but I think it's an attempt to do something that's more marginal, that's more, I guess, out there, for lack of a better way to put it, like a way that is more unique, I guess, that's harder to quite get a grasp on, that's more marginal and less mainstream, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's all fair and good. It's like, you know, you brought this up when we started this segment. You know, people, when Freud started doing psychoanalysis, it was a shock, right? People didn't mm-hmm. see it coming. And as a result, they were shocked when they encountered it. But then it became something that was no longer a shock. Because people came to analysis being like, I had a dream. Look at my mom was in the dream. And they were like playing into the tropes. And it wasn't shocking. And that's when Freud needed to adjust, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, Lacan says the same thing. Like, you know, if somebody comes to an analytic session and they expect that it'll last 50 minutes, like, you need to, psychoanalysis needs to have the capacity to sort of like provoke and surprise. Mm-hmm. And if you make it standardized, it loses its ability to do those things. And so that's one of the arguments, I suppose, for making it marginal, is that when it's marginal, it will provoke and surprise you the same way that like people were provoked and surprised by what was happening once they crossed over into the frontier, right? Like, it was more of an adventure in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why many people did it. Like, they wanted adventure. So they went to the place where you could be surprised a lot more easily than if you were to just stay in this area where there was more predictability mm-hmm. and whatnot. And so that's, I think, part of the argument about why psychoanalysis is better, maybe more effective, perhaps, when it's marginalized.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. I think that rings true to me. That definitely rings true to me. You know, it makes me think, this is a maybe a silly association, but it makes me think of when I've been to New York one time. I think I was like 11 years old. And as an 11-year-old, I pictured the state of New York as just being like New York City. And that's it. That's all that I thought of when I thought of New York. But when we got there, we stayed with an aunt and uncle, and they lived like outside of Albany. It wasn't even Albany proper. It was like a suburb of Albany. And so all there is in this town that we were in is like a train station, a gas station, and then farms. And like some people's homes and stuff. And it's weird when you're in a place like that. I mean, that happens where I live now as well. But the further away you get from these huge metropolitan areas, the more that people do just sort of weird stuff. Like, I see people around where I live that are riding snowmobiles in the street. I don't know if you could do that, because there's very few people that live here. I don't know if you could do that in like New York. Like, there's a certain set of expectations that exist in these huge areas. Like, you more or less know what to expect. You know that if you're in New York, people are going to be like really in a hurry. They're not going to want to stop and talk and like blah, blah, blah. And like in this weird little town where we were staying, or this weird little town where I live now, you don't know what you might see. You might, like, I see weird stuff. Like, I mentioned the guy in the snowmobile just on the street, and it's fine because there's no cars, there's no people. There, like, I don't know what, I could open my garage right now. I don't know what I might see over in this weird wooded place where I live. I don't know. It's mm-hmm. that's maybe a weird association, but it's the one that comes to mind.
I think that works. It makes me think of a different thing, a different comparison, I guess. You know, usually when people think of the Beatles, maybe I'm just assuming this. When I think of the Beatles, the image that comes to mind is of this, like, you know, band that was a worldwide phenomenon. And I imagine like them going places and people screaming and seeing them and passing out and so on and so forth. Right. Like that stuff that is the legend of the Beatles. They didn't start out like that. That wasn't mm-hmm. where they started. The Beatles, to get to that place, needed to be marginal first. They spent, I don't remember how many years, many years being a band in a strip club, you know, playing together. And they did it every night. Like, they played music together every night for years. And as a result, on the margins, that's where they were doing it. And as they were doing that, they were like, oh, we're in a strip club. Like, let's try this, which they probably wouldn't have been able to get away with if they were doing it on in a more like commercially successful venue. And they learned how each other played, and they tried stuff, and they learned things, blah, blah, blah. And that's what enabled them to become the kind of musicians that they were, right? Is that, they spent the time in the margins. If you don't spend the time in the margins, I mean, I don't know. It just seems like you'll miss something. And
I think you're right. This Beatles comparison is awesome because they kept doing it too, right? It's not like once they became massively successful, they didn't stop experimenting. I mean, the difference between Hard Day's Night and like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Oh my God, I can't say it. Lonely Hearts Club Band is massive. If you didn't know, you might not expect that those were by the same band. Right. They're wildly different. They kept trying different stuff.
That's what I think is the thing I'm trying to say about psychoanalysis too, right? Like, so when the Beatles did come out of the margins and they became like a huge commercial success, they could have just kept on doing like the same thing every single album, right? This is what people expect us to do, so we'll do that. But they didn't. They kept on trying to go back to the margins, right? By doing, which is what psychoanalysis, Freud and Lacan were doing, right? Once psychoanalysis, or once Lacanian psychoanalysis, became like the thing to do, people came to it with expectations. And then they're like, okay, this doesn't work if people come to it with knowing what they're going to get. It's not going to work the same way. So we need to change it and give them something that they don't expect. So for like Lacan, that could be a short session, right? Somebody comes expecting, I'll be here for 50 minutes. And he stops the session before that time or after, perhaps, you know, and that throws people off. That this isn't what I was expecting. And that's the thing, like, okay, this is, I'm going to struggle again to make this make sense, but I'm going to try. There's an exercise I'll do when I'll teach classes. I don't know if you were in any of the classes where I did this when you were a student, Jared, but
we'll see.
Yeah. I'll ask a class of students. I'll say, how many of you have a morning routine? And, you know, of course, the vast majority or all of the hands go up. And I'm like, great. Is there anybody who's willing to kind of like describe their morning routine? And, you know, people will do that. Then what I'll do is I'll follow that up with like, can somebody describe what happened in their morning this morning, today? And, you know, if I get a volunteer, they will tell me about something that was disrupted in their morning routine. This is fairly predictable. Yeah, I normally leave my house at, you know, 9 a.m. and I get to my work by like, you know, 9:30. But today I left at 9 a.m. There was an accident. And because there was an accident, I didn't get there until 9:45. So people will say things like that. All right. I went to go put some milk in my coffee and I looked in the fridge and we were out of milk. And the reason I bring this up in this conversation is to try to illustrate that when something unexpected happens, your autopilot turns off. And you have to like become more like, you have to start thinking more. You have to be a little bit more aware. You have to be more attuned to what's going on. And we live, I think, a huge portion of our lives just kind of like on autopilot. And in psychoanalysis, what happens is that because of the way that psychoanalysis works and the techniques that are deployed in the practice of it, you can't rely on your autopilot. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. If you try to autopilot it, the session won't work. You won't get anything out of it. It'll be terrible. It'll be boring. It'll be uncomfortable. It'll be lame. That's the thing, right? It in many ways, I would say, forces the autopilot to like be turned off, and you have to start like, you go into a session, you're like, I will try to free associate. And then you realize just how hard that is, right? You can't just like autopilot that. It doesn't work. So the point that I'm making with this in the Beatles, right, is that the Beatles, or, you know, they tried something, and when people heard it, they're like, that's not what I expected. And their autopilot turned off. They started to pay more attention. And psychoanalysis has to do the same thing. And I think in order to consistently maintain its ability to be surprising to people, in the way that it is and to turn their autopilots off, it kind of has to remain either in the margins or really close to them. Is sort of the argument that I'm making. And that I'm going to end on that for this segment. If you have anything else that you want to say, go for it. And I'll let you have the last word.
All right. Yeah. Just really briefly, you know, everything that you just said makes me think of, there's this way of describing the unconscious. You've probably heard it before that, that you find it, it makes itself known in these things that don't work, in these things that short circuit, in these things that, you know, you think you know what's going on, but something accidentally falls out. Something accidentally like just makes itself known, regardless of your intention. I everything that you just said made me think of that. I think it's an interesting parallel that what you're looking for is what doesn't work, what fails in the narrative, in the speech, in the clinic, not the things that are working. That's not interesting to psychoanalysis, I don't think. So we're back for our third act. Our third act is called Various Sundry Things. Since I did the psychoanalysis of everyday life, Neil, why don't you tell us about some various sundry things?
All right. So this is a weird one because I'm going to do some self-promotion, and I feel weird doing self-promotion. It makes me feel self-conscious when I do it. But whatever. Apparently not so self-conscious that I won't do it. One of the things that I do, one of the things that I do in addition to, thinking that what I have to say is important enough to record it and put into a podcast, right, is I write an email newsletter that I send out when I'm, responsible on a weekly basis. When I get really busy, sometimes I'm not able to do that. It's been called Complex Praxis. And it kind of divides up into different segments that where I talk about kind of like what's going on, what I'm reading, what I'm listening to, so different things like that. It's trying to say to people, hey, look, there's some things, I think these things are interesting or useful or both. Maybe you'll think they're interesting or useful or both, blah. And one of the sections was always called Lacanian Mojo, where I would attempt to kind of like riff on some sort of Lacanian concept or idea. And I'm relaunching the newsletter. I've decided that I need to change it up because it doing that every single week was taking an enormous amount of time. And, I have one small child, and very soon I will have a second small child. And I know that I'm not going to have the time to do it. So I've decided to change it up, and I'm renaming the email newsletter. It's going to be called The Gorman Limit. Again, a narcissistically titled email newsletter for me, the narcissistic podcaster. Maybe you have to be kind of narcissistic to do a podcast.
I think you kind of do.
All right, cool. Let's just say that you do.
We both are.
There we have it, right? And in addition to that, I also do an email newsletter. It's called The Gorman Limit. And if people wanted to sign up for that newsletter, this is the self-promotion part, you could do that. It's pretty easy. If you just went to this URL, limit.neilgorman.com, you'd see a thing, you'd type in your email, and it would send you a thing saying, do you really want to do this? And you'd click yes. And now then you'd get these things in your inbox. The way my plan kind of going forward into 2021, what I'm going to attempt to do is send out a weekly thing, which is more just like the update thing that I said, like, here's some interesting stuff that you might be into. And then once a month to send something about Lacanian stuff, because that's the part that was really hard to write. It took a long time to write that. And I think if I do that about once a month, I can probably do it. And if that's the thing that you're into, then you could go and you could sign up for that. The other reason I'm doing this, I'm trying to consolidate a lot of stuff. I have different services all over the internet that I've been using and paying for. And last week when I talked about cleaning up my basement, I'm also now attempting to kind of do this thing where I look at all of the places where my money goes, and I'm asking myself, do I really use that thing? Or do I use it enough to justify continuing to pay for it? And in many instances, the answer to that is no. One of the things where the answer was yes is I have my own website, neilgorman.com, and I just redesigned that recently as well. And the newsletter redesign was a part of that larger redesign. And so that's my various sundry thing, is to talk about my personal website and my email newsletter, me, so on and so forth. Now I'm going to kick it over to you so that you can make fun of me for being such a self-aggrandizing sort of dude.
It's funny you say that. That's exactly what I was going to do. No, I'm just, I'm just kidding. What I will say is that, you know, if you're someone who listens to this, I would recommend reading Neil's newsletters. There's always good stuff in there. I tend to read them when I get them, but I'll be honest. I sometimes it gets caught in. I really need to clear out my email crap, but it gets caught, so I miss them. So a lot of times I'll read it via your website instead. But there's always good stuff in there. I don't know. It's hard to describe because there's a lot of stuff going on in your newsletters, Neil. But there's always good stuff in there. I find a lot of good music in there that I otherwise probably wouldn't have stumbled across. When you do write about what's on your mind about Lacan, it's always interesting. It's sometimes still very hard, but it's always interesting.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. That's very nice of you to say. It's one of those things that the reason I started doing it was that it was a way to hold myself accountable. Like if people were expecting me to produce something, I would produce it, and that worked worked until it didn't, you know. But it is. It's nowadays. It's something that I hope can be used. You know, I'm thinking if I'm going to think about this stuff, slowing myself down and trying to take some of my thoughts and render them into writing helps clarify it for me. And I thought, oh, maybe other people would be interested in this stuff too. And you know, I'll make it so that they can see it if they want. And that was the idea there, not to try to force it on anybody, but to make it available to those who might be interested. So there, that's my various sundry thing for this week. All right. And I'm going to stop. Well, that's not true. I'm going to feel weird that I did this now for a little bit. I don't know, I'm going to be second guessing myself. Should I have talked about that? Should I have not talked about that? Was that too much? Whatever, but it's, it's out there now. So I guess it doesn't really matter. Anything else that we should be covering this week, Jared, or do you think that's good enough for now?
No, I think that's good enough for now. I think there's probably still much left to be said about our topic from today, but we'll see what happens.
I would agree with that. I think that it's interesting, right? We talked about it last time and then time went by and it was kind of rattling around in our heads. And, you know, I think that's been kind of productive for me. My suspicion is that it will continue to rattle around in my head for sure. It seems like you're nodding, so it'll probably be rattling around in yours as well. So we will probably come back to this. I don't know if we'll come back to it in the next episode or not. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. But at some point in the future, we will be coming back to this.
Agreed.
All right. Well, in that case, I'm going to put in the cool music that I put in to the end of the podcast that signifies that we're done here. I'm going to do that. Jared, you're the person who made this music.
Oh, yeah, I guess I am.
Yeah, you know, so if you like this little bit of music at the end, this is a Cat's Meow production. You know, that's what you're hearing here. So, Jared, thanks for taking the time to hang out today and talk. I appreciate it.
It's been
fun. All right. And those of you who are listening, thanks for taking the time to download this and have us in your ears for a little bit. Until next time, you know, make glorious mistakes. Don't let the man keep you down. And, you know, let's hang out in the margins a little bit.